There isn't another sport that travels around the world quite like Formula One. From Bahrain, Australia, and the USA, to Great Britain, Singapore, and Mexico, F1 drops in on its millions of fans in every corner of the planet, bringing 20 of the greatest racing drivers on Earth along for the ride.
But it isn't just the drivers who travel. If anything, despite them having a tendency to moan every now and then, trust me, racing drivers like a moan, they're the easiest things to transport. So this week, F1 explains how we travel across the planet with, well, everything else really. Hello, my name is Christian Hugill.
And I'm Katie Osborne, and every week we find answers to your questions about the incredible world of Formula One racing. And we love it when you record those questions and send them to us. That's what these two did.
Hi, Katie and Christian. My name is Danny, and I am from Seattle, Washington.
Hi, my name is Alex Nicholson. I'm from Reading, England, but live in Boston, Massachusetts, in the USA.
With the amount of moving parts over a race weekend, who or what team is in charge of all the logistics? Is there a director of operations? Is there one for the race itself? And does each team have one? How does everyone know where they need to be when?
How does the logistics of Formula One work?
I am curious. Thanks so much. Love your podcast.
Thank you very much.
We've also had questions on this from
Miranda in North Dakota,
Nancy in Niagara Falls,
Danielle in Edinburgh,
Aswin in India,
Jocelyn in Vancouver,
Todd from Maryland,
Preston in Washington, D.C.,
Paul from Alberta, and many, many more. Christian, I just kind of feel like we just read from the back of the grid to the front of the grid. That was a lot of fun.
It was fun. And considering how bad I am at pronouncing names of places, that could have got a lot worse as well. That was all right.
Yeah, you did pretty well.
Thank you.
A plus.
Yes, anyway, they have all asked questions about the logistics of Formula One, how all the stuff needed to race in the sport is moved from one country to another, sometimes in a matter of days. Now, what goes into taking this travelling motorsport circus all around the world is fascinating, and it's being done more sustainably than ever before. We will dig into all of that in just a minute.
But first, don't forget you can send us your questions on anything that you would like. If it's F1 related, we'll answer it. Write some words or send a voice note to ywhy@f1.com. That's our email address.
It is indeed. And we just wanted to say thank you so much for all your questions for our first ever F1 Explains live show at the US Grand Prix in Austin, Texas. Who knows? You might be listening to this on your way to the race or the way home. If you didn't manage to make it to the Circuit of the Americas, don't worry. The live show will be on this feed very soon. Make sure you hit follow or subscribe and you won't miss out. And speaking of travel, that's the point of this episode, really. You asked us how F1 moves around the world, and we're going to answer. We'll be dropping in on one of our teams and big friends of F1 Explained shortly, but first to a company who are a constant presence on roads all over the world, DHL.
Yeah, Christian, DHL is the global partner of Formula One and have been for almost 40 years. So let's start by looking at how they get things to the track. Paul Fowler is the company's head of motorsports logistics. Paul, welcome to F1 Explains.
Paul, let's start off very broadly. What exactly does DHL do for Formula One?
We move every single kilo to every single race, 23, 24 races we're going up to, from continent to continent, from European race to European race.
Paul, we always are guided by our listeners on this podcast. Our listeners are very curious about Formula One, and we answer those questions. And you might be surprised, you might not be surprised to know just how many we've had on the sort of logistics side of Formula One. So starting off with Nancy in Niagara Falls and Jocelyn in Vancouver, who come from different parts of the world. Presumably Nancy sent her question via a waterproof phone. But Nancy asks how all the F1 paddock is transported. And Jocelyn wants to know what means of transportation is used.
We use every mode for every single race. So there'll be sea freight that'll be arriving as the first wave of the biceps of equipment that the teams have. So that arrives ahead of the race. We'll have trucking locally because sustainable was a big must in our planning today. So anything that we can regionalize will be trucked in. And then finally, for all the urgent equipment, especially on an air freight or an international leg, there'll be seven 777s that will be bringing that equipment to the race.
Now, I suppose the next logical question to that then, Paul, is what is in all these boxes, whether it's on boats, on sea freight, in the sky. What stuff are you bringing to Formula One?
So the first equipment is the real hardware that can be replicated, from wiring to garage dress to the overhead gantries, et cetera, et cetera. And all of that goes sea freight because it's heavy, it's bulky, and it can be replicated. The part that's air freighted is the technical, the computer, that then plugs into these docking stations. And that's the only way that they could really build it in the timescales that they do. So the last part is the cars, equipment, essential parts.
And that includes arguably the most important part of Formula One, Paul. The car does it. DHL has an active role in getting cars from race to race.
Absolutely. The cars fly to every single race, definitely.
And a question I'm asked a lot, Paul, about Formula One's globe-trotting tendencies is, are these cars flown as one would expect to see them on track and it gets rolled out, or are they broken down completely?
I've been in, just as a backdrop, I've been in the business 37 years, so man and boy. We used to ship them on double stack car racks as cars, and there used to be three per team. So there was a whole racking system specially built to fit on the aircraft. Nowadays, because of the technicalities and the amount of spares that are sent back after a race, these are broken down really to the tub, the central part that the driver sits in. And then they go into what's known as a track shack. And then on top of that, all of the spares are sent back for rebuild and servicing, and then back out to the race in between races. So it's a whole logistic trail. But the cars now today, in answer to your question, probably a bit in depth, are shipped now in a broken down state.
Can I ask a really stupid question here, Paul? Because as soon as you talk about that, my mind goes to whenever you move. I fairly recently moved. You're putting all your stuff that's worth money.
Yeah.
And you're wrapping it up in anything you can get your hands on. A towel. Yeah. I'll put this towel over the telly because in the event of an accident, my towel will give it some form of protection. How on earth do you make sure these things keep safe? Because Formula One cars are almost priceless in their worth. It just, as one of life's worriers, Paul, strikes me as an awful lot of pressure to make sure these things get there in one piece.
Yeah, the over the years, and especially now with the sustainable push, we've gone to 777s. So there are special containers that are made. I mean, that they are, for want of another word, sheds, but everyone knows how much they fit in their sheds. So all of the equipment is lined up, packed very carefully. They have foam-lined boxes, etc., with the shape of the wing, the front wing, etc., that they slot in so they can't move for transport. And then they are loaded into these track sheds, stroke sheds. And then we pick them up as units, and they are wrapped, netted, and go straight to the airline. So the handling is really team-based and then hand over to us for movement.
Formula One travels around the world in protective sheds. I love it. You're not getting that on any other podcast. Now, garages where you see teams do their pit stops tend to be permanent fixtures at racetrack. The motorhomes, the hospitality units are shipped to the European races. But what we call in Formula One, the flyaway races, so Bahrain, Abu Dhabi, Austin, they have buildings either provided for them or permanent buildings for the motorhomes there. So those motorhomes that we just talked about aren't going all around the world, are they, Paul? They're just going to the European races.
That's correct. I mean, they send by sea freight a lot of the corporate dress. So you get the same corporate feel, the same race team feel. So those permanent buildings will be dressed in the liveries and the sponsors, etc. Now that is all shipped. That's all good. That all goes by sea freight. And as we move to an attempt to go regionalization in a sustainable format, which is becoming a big part of our push and our decision process, there are more trucking and some of the teams are looking now to house them out in those regions so that we truck them in. So I would imagine that over a period of time, you may see some motorhomes feature in some of the international races, depending on the track. Obviously, we're going to Vegas, for example. That's not a permanent track, so it would work there. But some of them, as you say, are permanent concrete buildings, so you can't replace that with a motorhome. So depending on the track, but we are looking at that as part of our sustainable push.
And we'll talk about sustainability in just a second, Paul. I want to come back to that. But before we move on to that, just briefly summarise then what sort of things, if you were to make a little bit of a list that DHL is putting in, whether it's trucks on the road, whether it's sea freight or whether it's in the air, what sort of things are you bringing from race to race?
Well, we say everything. I mean, the simple answer is everything, because it literally it's exactly that. We move the whole entire team. We provide support and uplift for all the television equipment. So the Formula One TV village currently, tyres, fuel, the support races, so F2, F3 when they go there. So it's the entire circus is moved by us. There's obviously some consumable parts like water, etc., that's all sourced naturally, and that makes sense to do so. But the actual hardware of a team is moved by DHL.
Paul, let's get on to some of our listeners' questions. And we've had loads about this, too many to mention. So apologies if you sent this question in. If we were to list them all, we'd be here all day. But basically, a lot of questions asking about F1's push to become more sustainable. You see Formula One talking about it an awful lot. The green banners at the side of the racetracks. Obviously, DHL's working with F1 to help reduce the carbon footprint of the sport. It's something we're all trying to do across the world. How's DHL helping with F1's push on this, Paul?
We're absolutely involved at the base with every decision, and we work really closely with F1 to achieve that. Obviously, logistics is one of the biggest emission producers, be that people and be that the logistics of moving the freight around. So in air, we're introducing more and more 777s, including our own fleet, which reduces the carbon footprint. In marine, we're insetting or offsetting using cleaner biofuels. And now for Europe, we've introduced a concept as much as we can with trucking. So we've got 20 new biofuel trucks, 18 deployed for Formula One TV. So they're 83% cleaner than last year. And that's kind of set the standard where the teams are now coming to us. There are logistic restraints where it's not available. So, you know, everyone talks about infrastructure when we talk about electric cars. The same applies for HVO Gen 2. It's not rolled out and available in all corners of Europe at the moment. So we have to find trick solutions for that. Even small things like production, we made sure they had 850-litre double-size fuel tanks so they get extra range. So there's a lot of things like that that we're doing in the background that will roll out, and we'll keep introducing them as we go forward. And it's weird where the focus was on cost or on ability to do the job, because you can't have risk to the race. The race has got to happen. Sustainability is woven amongst all of that today. So we have to make a sort of like every answer has to answer three questions now, and sustainability is at the top of it.
And you mentioned some specific planes there, Paul. Was it 777? Did I get that right? I don't know as much about planes as I know about Formula One cars, I have to be honest.
Yeah, it's a 777 freighter aircraft. So if you ever travelled on a 777, or if you sit and look at the back of your seat and to your interest in all aircraft, you feel like, on next time you're in a 777, the whole of that top deck you're sitting is removed and it's pure cargo.
So, and that is more fuel efficient, I presume.
Those aircrafts are more fuel efficient, and we've moved away from the 747. I think it's 14% more efficient than a 747.
Something that you mentioned earlier, Paul, is sea freight. And famously, it takes longer to get to somewhere via the sea than it does via the sky. How far in advance are ships setting off? Because I imagine that it is heavy stuff that's being shipped. And as I say, I imagine that's not making the journey at a massive speed.
No, the average vessel will be running at about 20 knots an hour. So it's slow. So the longest trip we've got is Melbourne, 42 days. We plan now, the calendar's out now. So we're already planning with the teams whether to send directly from the last race being Abu Dhabi, some of their equipment, regionalizing some in Bahrain, or sending direct to the next race. So as soon as the calendar's published, we start looking at the end of 2023 to roll it forward to 2024. Most teams have six sets. One team has five sets of this equipment, and we kind of dovetail it in and move it around from three or four launch pads from the globe. And once we're in position, normally we can hit a race with 10 days at sea time, so 10 transit days at sea, plus the collection, the delivery, the customs part at each end. So we can hit most events within a two, 3 week window, but the longest ones, obviously, you can't decrease the size of the Earth. So 42 days and 7 weeks is the Melbourne transit.
Okay, there's a number of things I'm obsessed with here. The first, for those who haven't got their sea legs, 20 knots is roughly about 23 miles per hour. That's about 37 kilometres an hour. So again, that's fairly slow. And they are going for 40-odd days across the world. It's astonishing. And Paul, does what you just said there mean effectively that it's possible for some of this freight to finish at the last race of the season in Abu Dhabi and then immediately start its journey to Bahrain for round one of the next season?
Yes. No, that happens today, and it's been happening for a few of the years, so there's not really a stop to the season. They pack it now in a way with you've got smart freight, and they use the word dumb freight, but it's not. It's stuff that doesn't need to be checked or changed or tweaked or livery applied if it's a sponsor item. So some of the equipment will come back and be refreshed and then turned around, and some will go on to the next races.
Formula One never stops. This machine just never stops. It's always moving. It's amazing. Formula One freight doesn't get a Christmas break. Unbelievable. And I'm imagining it's quite a puzzle, Paul, to get everything, you know, bear in mind there's the different modes of transport, the different teams. I imagine it's a bit of a puzzle to make sure it all arrives at the same time and same place when it needs to.
It's weird you should say that. We say grown-up Tetris. So there you go. That's the answer to your puzzle. It's all coming at us, and we know it can be put together, and we know it can come out in the right place. So grown-up Tetris. That kind of the calendar dictates the size of the movement. But that said, when you look at Singapore to Japan in a week, you know, 900 ton of freight, 120 sea freight containers, etc. It's a huge move, and it's what you said right at the beginning. You know, fans turn their TV off after the Singapore race, and 1 week later or 5 days later for the free practice one, they're turning their TV on, and it's all in Japan.
We have a question from Preston in Washington, D.C. He says, what's the biggest challenge of moving F1 around the world? And what's the craziest thing a team moves for a race weekend?
Okay, challenge for us is always time. Obviously, the race is happening, the calendar's set, so we can't make more of it. So if we have a delay or an issue, weather that is out of our control, that window's always closing and the sand's ticking from that sand timer all the time. So once we've got it there, we know we're putting the pressure on to the teams because their time at track has been reduced to have everything set up, the car set up, etc. So the biggest challenge by far is time. And the more distance the races are and the more back-to-backs, week apart races that we have, that just increases. So that for sure is our biggest challenge. Regarding what people bring and move, I mean, we in some cases, sponsor-driven, you know, we are moving things like water. If there's a sponsor, San Pellegrino for Ferrari, for etc. Italians like their food, so some home pasta sometimes, champagne, etc., etc. So, you know, you've got to remember these people are on the road 9 months and those home comforts like English tea, HP sauce, all of those tiny things that can make you feel at home provide value and motivation for the team. So we see a lot of home-for-home comforts as well.
I'll tell you what, Paul, if I was away for 24 races, my particular brand of tea that I like, that I won't say which one, but it's based from the Yorkshire region, that would have to come with me, I think. Yeah, I think that I can see that. Spot the British guy.
But they're the little things you don't realise until you're out on the road for that length of time. So
absolutely. Paul, it's such a fascinating world. Really do appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us on F1 Explains. Really interesting insight.
No problem. Thank you for inviting me.
That is getting to the track, but what happens once we're there? Time to welcome Georgia Tirabassi. She is DHL's Formula One trackside coordinator. So, Georgia, as you know, we've just been speaking to your colleague, Paul. We know how the F1 circus gets to the circuit, but how does DHL help trackside? What's your role?
I focus mainly on the air freight. I am part of the office that is based in the paddock, so I get to attend every single race, both in Europe and international. We do have a lot of import and export shipments that are coming in Europe. As you can imagine, it's mainly trucks and road freight, but we take care of every single kind of transport. So sea freight, air freight, road freight, customs, everything. At Trackside, we do everything, meaning that we need to be capable to sort any issue that may arise.
Yeah, you mentioned you guys do a little of everything. What exactly are those things? You know, is it the freight for the teams with their cars? Is it perhaps, you know, pit stop equipment, motorhomes?
So anything that you see at the circuit, apart from the circuit itself, we move it. That's okay. It sounds it out perfectly because we do move like the race car spare parts, we move the forks and knife in Paddock Club, we move the TV broadcast equipment, we move tires, we move fuel. So anything that you see at the circuit, we move it.
Georgia, as we've just said, we were speaking to Paul. Imagine a situation where like everything's arrived and you're Trackside coordinator. So what are you then looking to do once everything for an F1 weekend has arrived? And when would that typically be? And I'm getting a clue by when we're talking to you. So we are talking to you, Georgia. Obviously, podcasts are recorded in advance. So we're happy to say that as me and Katie sit here now, it's Thursday, the 28th of September. And the next Grand Prix weekend is Qatar, which is a week tomorrow, is Friday practice. So we're talking 8 days from Friday practice. But Georgia, you're already on your way to Qatar, aren't you? So when do you get there and what are you doing once you get to the track? Because the fact that you're not sat at home now tells us that there's quite a lot to do.
Yeah, so our operation starts normally the week before the race week. We start with our sea freight inbound on a Tuesday normally, and then we keep going until after the week after the race week. So we stay in every country for approximately 15 days. Every single day of the week, there is something coming. And as soon as we are done with the import, we start with the export. So the last day we finish like the import shipment, so the actual freight arriving to the F1 circuit is normally Saturday, the day before the race. I mean, we don't have time to say we are done, because as soon as we are, we start focusing on the export side of the operation. So it is an ongoing operation. Every single day we have got something. So we never really stop.
Yeah, it sounds that way. And as somebody who is on the road myself quite a bit, and I'm trying to do the math here, and I'm looking at the calendar as you're talking, actually, thinking to myself, we're getting to the weeds about your specific job, but I'm just wanting to clarify, you basically are going from one race location to the next location, and you only go home to like whenever you need a closet change. Like, I'm just trying to figure out.
Katie's basically asking the question I was thinking, when on earth do you go home?
Well, I'm going home for 4 days after Qatar. We get to see the whole operations, and I don't think anyone realizes how much time it takes to create an F1 race, an event like F1.
What's the workflow? What's the first priority for the on-track team at a race weekend?
Okay, so in my job, doing air freight, every day we have got deliveries. So every day we need to check with the airport, with the customs agent, with everyone to ensure that we are at the circuit on time. Every single team will expect our freight by a certain time. So we always need to be on track. And every day we deliver something and up until Saturday. So every day we are planning on the next days and we just get that sorted. As we are planning on the deliveries, we are also planning on the return shipment at the same time, because after the race, every team will send back something. Of course, it depends on how many accidents they have as well. So we may have got last minute shipments we need to arrange based on a crash or anything that has happened on the race weekend. But as a rule, everything is pre-planned as much as possible. But there is no such job where you start with plan A and you end up with plan B, C, D, E, F until you have got one, because it will always change every single day. So it's very challenging in a way, but it keeps you alive as well.
Yeah, it keeps the adrenaline pumping, the heart thumping, all of the things.
And Georgia, how many people do DHL have at the track over the course of a race weekend? Because me and Katie have both we're lucky enough to have been to several Grand Prix, and there seems to be plenty of people in the sort of recognisable red and yellow of DHL, and there's DHL looks like a real presence. How many people is all this taking?
So in Europe, we've got approximately 40 people, which includes office people, our truck drivers, our forklift driver, our ground staff. So in Europe, we have a bigger number. In an international event, we are approximately 20, again, including everyone in the office and forklift drivers and operators.
And the point really is to not see your guys' workflow, right? Like as a fan or as someone attending the event weekends or watching from home, we want to know that DHL and your team exists, but we don't necessarily see you guys working. And that probably is a goal. Is that a good way to summarize that?
I always get asked, what do I do? Because no one really can understand what is logistics in F1. What do you do at the circuit? I don't think anyone realizes what's behind the scene, what happens, how a circuit is built, how the freight gets there, how hard it is, how everything is urgent. Because, of course, every single part, every single box in Formula One is urgent. It must be there. It has to be there because it could affect the race, the TV broadcast going live. So every single shipment in our job matters. There is no room for delay. There is no room for mistakes because everything is extremely important. If you don't hear about us, then it means we've done a good job. Everything is there. Nothing is missing. The race can happen. So in a way, it's good.
They're unsung heroes of Formula One. And George, there was something that you said earlier that interested me, because obviously so much of this will be planned, right? You know that F1 teams are going to need their motorhomes. So you arrange that and then it gets delivered and then the teams put it up. You know they're going to need their catering units. You know they're going to need their tyres, their parts. But let's look at a situation, for example, like Logan Sargeant in the Japanese Grand Prix qualifying. Logan has a big crash.
There it is, Logan Sargeant, who has found the barriers. The American driver has a couple of wheels not pointing in the right direction. The red flag is out.
He's out of the qualifying session, and the team needed to repair the car to such an extent that Logan actually got a 10-second penalty for the race in Japan because Formula One teams aren't allowed a spare car anymore, but like they used to be in the 90s and 2000s because of cost saving. Now, that was in Japan. Williams are based in the UK. Is that the sort of thing DHL would have had to help with? Or would Williams already have all the spare parts they could possibly need with them? Or is someone from Williams getting on the phone once Logan crashes going, guys, we're going to need this, this and this from our factory back in the UK?
Well, that is part of my job. It may seem weird, but like keeping an eye on the TV and watching the race is my job. I need to see what happens. I need to see if there is any crashes because the moment a team crashes, they phone me and ask me to send something back.
See, that's fascinating. I would have never have known that.
And within half an hour from that, I get a call and they ask me, can we send this back? And I have to arrange it. If I have paid attention to what has happened, I can start planning already.
Yeah.
On what I need, and we send it back as urgent as possible.
You and your team really bring to light what these shows are. And again, it's one of those things where if you weren't doing the job right, we would all notice on the outside. But because we don't notice the day-to-day and what you guys are doing, that's the difference-making.
Georgia, before we let you go, I think often when we're in our work lives, there's something that we wish people knew about our job. For example, I know that Katie wishes that the listeners to this podcast knew just how difficult I am to work with because, I'm a nightmare and Katie wishes people knew that. But,
miserable. Oh, yes, awful. Just miserable.
Terrible man, terrible. But with your job, Georgia, what do you wish that F1 fans knew about your job? Because we've already established that DHL are the unsung heroes of Formula One.
In a way, I have to say, sometimes I wish they knew more about it because especially if you are a woman working in logistics in Formula One, it is difficult to be taken seriously as well. They don't really realize what we do. They just think that maybe I am the face of it. I just the image of the company, but I'm not. I am actually a coordinator. I get every single shipment at the track and back to the F1 factories. So there is a full job behind it that no one really is aware of. I mean, we have to make sure it gets here on time, regardless of what has happened. That side of the job that makes it different, because there is no room for delays, no room for mistakes. We have to find a way to make it happen. So I would define my job especially as in, I am an expert in finding solution to problems, because that's what my daily job is. I get given an issue and I have to solve it. My challenge is finding the best solution to the issue.
I love that.
Love it. Georgia, brilliant insight. And hopefully people will know that a little bit more at the end of this podcast. Thanks so much for joining us on F1 Explains, Georgia.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
So that is getting to the track. We also know what DHL does at the track, but DHL can't do everything. I've long said that. So if you've ever seen F1 on the TV, you'll have seen the guys and girls wearing team branded high-vis jackets, setting up and packing up, particularly if you hang around to watch the post-race show on something like F1 TV.
And that is where our race teams come in. So, of course, Christian, I have someone from one of those teams ready to talk to us. Joseph Vandal is Alfa Romeo's head of race part logistics. Hey, Joseph, welcome to F1 Explains.
Happy to be here with you guys. Thank you for the invitation.
Our pleasure. And Joseph, just explain for us, what is a summary of your job?
Well, a summary of my job, and it's hard to describe. Basically, we try to ship all the race parts or the parts for the cars, inclusively the cars and all the equipment around the world. It's more than 20 races and there is loads of equipment involved, sea freight, air freight, and it's constantly moving and it never really stops.
That sounds like Formula One at its finest, that it just never really stops. Even though there's an off season, you guys are always doing something in the mix of it all.
Unless the shutdown, then we are not allowed
it,
to.
That's it.
Extremely well snuck in there, Joseph, just in case the FIA are listening. Unless, of course, for the shutdown. Hint, hint, FIA gods.
Yeah. Very well said. And of course, you know, one of the important things we've talked about on this show is the fact that so many of the logistics happen for all of us fans and consumers of the content. We show up on race day to watch a great race and qualifying and practice. And yet at the same time, there is so much that goes into and out of these event weekends. If you could kind of big picture the summary for an event weekend for you, what is that like?
Well, the weekend, actually, it starts like minimum 10 days before the actual Friday starts. Trucks like motorhomes, they have to leave from the home base towards the racetrack, that they usually arrive there a week before the actual race happens or the cars are running. And then obviously from a Saturday, it starts, garage starts, setup starts, as well as the motorhomes are getting built up. And then it takes us about 5 days to have everything built up and ready to show for the Thursday when everybody appears at the racetrack and before, obviously, the show starts on Friday.
Joseph, we've heard from Paul and Georgia from DHL, and they've basically explained how they get freight and all the stuff to the racetrack. I'm guessing at some point DHL hand it over to you guys, and what's the first thing you do when you receive all this stuff and you stood there at the track, as you say, sort of anywhere from a week to 10 days before the Grand Prix, and it's like, right, here we go then. What happens then?
Oh, well, first to say, it's a big difference between Europeans and overseas. Overseas, everything is, or not everything, but most of the stuff is handled by DHL and F1 Cargo. While at Europeans, we as Sauber or Alfa Romeo F1 team, we try to be more or less independent. So we transport at the Europeans everything ourselves in a total of 15 trucks. There's 8 for the garage and 7 solely for the motorhome. Those trucks basically go from race to race and it's more or less organized only from our side.
Wow, that's an undertaking.
But once arrived, obviously, and there is loads of people just waiting to unpack and unload everything. Again, there is the setup trucks carrying all the equipment, which at the Europeans, it's roughly 2 trucks. And then we build the garage from scratch, and there is nothing there. When we arrive there, it's an empty garage. It's few cabling is already done, provided by F1 Broadcast Center. And then we just start from scratch.
Joseph, so obviously the very first thing is the garage, which, as you say, is a shell, and that's everything, isn't it? From places for tools, from the team branding and everything like that. At what point does building up the car come into it from a team's perspective?
I mean, this varies again as well from race to race, but usually at Europeans, we try to prepare it back in the factory on the Monday before the race starts, and then we ship the cars more or less built to the track on a Tuesday. So they arrive there on Wednesday morning together with the mechanics, and then the fine-tuning and from our engine supplier, the parts arrive, which have to be fitted there. They're really getting prepared on Wednesdays always. This is the same for Europeans and overseas.
So how does that work exactly, again, from a big picture standpoint of a racetrack that's a bit further away with a back-to-back weekend? Car is then transported from one race weekend or one race location to the next location, or does it happen to go home in the process of then coming back over to another race location to be built?
Usually it doesn't go back to the factory. Overseas,
okay,
definitely not. At Europeans, only when there is a single race between a back-to-back. For example, Austria to Silverstone, there is not really a chance to travel via Switzerland.
Does that put extra pressure on the team?
It puts a lot of extra pressure on the people because everything and in planning and as well the mechanics, they're under pressure to have everything ready for two races already because everything else a little bit delayed and which holds up the whole operation then.
And we heard from Paul a little bit earlier in the podcast, of course, who was saying that for some of the flyaway races, as they're known, then the cars are then dismantled. And as you say, for some of the closer to Europe ones, they are shipped out sort of almost whole. Joseph, your first appearance on this podcast, but far from Katie's. And Katie will know that I often find myself wanting to visit the places that our listeners are from. We get a lot of our listeners sending questions to this podcast, Paul. Have either of you ever been to Ocean City in Maryland?
No.
Katie, have you?
Interestingly enough, my husband had, there was a conversation about an interview there in Ocean City, Maryland. I've never been, but in fact, out of all places, that is a place that my next life could be in, is Ocean City, Maryland.
There you go. Katie might be going. The reason I ask is because it sounds like I want to live in Ocean City. I mean, what a place to say. I live in Ocean City. It sounds great, doesn't it? And I tell you who also lives there is Todd from Ocean City in Maryland. And Todd sent us a question. He says, I'm amazed at the amount of personnel, equipment, technology, extra parts, etc. that teams require on race weekend. So what exactly do they bring? How many cars and what extra parts? Joseph?
Well, basically, we have three cars or three chassis at the track at every race and roughly parts to build up five. So
really?
We've got minimum two spare parts of each.
Just in case.
So you're building in some crashes there, Joseph, is effectively what you're saying.
Not really crashes, but sometimes we need to change from weekend to weekend, and quantity of five parts per race weekend, you're pretty safe.
I may be asking a ridiculous question, but I'm doing it on behalf of Todd here, Joseph. How many parts, roughly? How much stuff are we talking?
This is a good question, but
it's Todd's, not mine. All credit to Todd.
A Formula One car is built on every single screw and every single part, and I only can guess. I would say it's about 30,000 parts, something like that.
Silly, isn't it?
That is wild.
Talking in terms of tons, it's about 30 tons of air freight we're shipping with the plane. And equipment-wise, we've got another 25 tons of equipment we are shipping to every single event.
Are we talking 30,000 parts per car?
Yeah. So it's not only the big chokers like engine covers and this, but it's I would say it's around 30,000 parts per car.
I loved how mild faced Joseph was in answering your question. It was just yes. Your face red.
Yeah, obviously.
Is there one person in particular who is responsible for counting all of the screws?
I hope not.
No, you know what I mean? Big picture, there is someone who's accountable for the equipment to go from wherever to wherever. And is there someone who is the counter?
Is there a head of screws, Joseph?
There must be a head of screws as well. No, we try to split it up a little bit. So there is many people responsible for various things. So there is one department responsible for uprights, another one for suspension legs, and they're trying to make sure that all the correct and the correct quantities appear in the racetrack as well.
And one of the things that we've talked about in this is better understanding when the equipment shows up at the track, all of this 30,000 parts, right? How many people really are responsible for making sure they go from point A to point B?
Basically, it's everybody's responsible, because a mechanic is not only a mechanic, he's backing up as well, unloading everything. So it's about 60 people involved. Setting it up is like 6 people. Then there is about 15 mechanics building the cars. Backing up, everybody's responsible that everything goes into the correct place again.
Joseph, I'm not sure if this is your first podcast appearance, but let me tell you, you're doing an excellent job, because as well as answering Todd from Ocean City's question, Todd, let us know if you're happy with the answer, and also let us know if Ocean City's as nice as it sounds. But also in that answer, we also answered Chris Closer's question, who asked, are F1 cars shipped in sections or are they shipped as entire cars? We now know that. And Aswin in India asked, how many spare parts would a team carry? So without even realising it, Joseph, you've managed to answer those questions. And Georgia from DHL told us a little earlier that when a team needs to organise delivery of extra parts, for example, for an unprecedented crash, they phone DHL straight away and say, right, we're going to need to bring this over from the factory. How does that work from your perspective? Because that particularly interested me.
Yes, that's what we do more or less on a daily basis or on a weekly basis. We are always in touch with DHL because, like the late shipments, they are all organized via DHL. And for instance, like Suzuka, we make a request to DHL, tell them we need 5 boxes with spare parts to be shipped from Switzerland to Suzuka and then back from Japan to Switzerland again as well. Georgia and DHL, they're doing a great job in making it always possible that it's happening somehow in a very short time. I don't know if ever somebody tried to send something to Japan, but usually it takes 3 weeks, Switzerland to Japan or the other way around, and we managed to do it in like a matter of 4 days, including all the custom formalities. And with the help of DHL, it's getting delivered straight to the garage or in front of the garage, so that the person out there only, there's a big word in this case, only needs to unload it and put it to the car.
I tell you what I notice about you Formula One people, Joseph, and I don't know whether it's the same for you, but none of you seem to relax very much. You know, the race weekend finishes, and if it was me, before I started packing up, I'd have at the very least have a coffee and something to eat. But it always strikes me that the minute a race finishes, or sometimes when the race hasn't even finished yet, you see people starting to pack up. And it always makes me quite sad because I'm inevitably not ready to go home yet. I'm like, I'm enjoying myself. Don't pack up yet. Still 10 laps to go.
How long is it from end of race to taillights leaving the track?
Our aim or our usual goal is in roughly six and a half hours till everything is packed up.
You guys get food, right?
Our catering is very good, and they're always supplying a really good quality food all over the globe.
Okay, good.
It's a challenge as well to find the places where it's not always that easy.
I'll tell you, incentivizing whatever it can be for those six and a half hours to get some taillights going for your guys' crew to get back on the road. That's a solid way to do so.
Never say we don't dig into the important topics on this podcast. We really do.
There is hard deadlines as well. And I think it usually is about 9 hours after checkered flag that the air freight at the overseas races has to be backed up.
It's astonishing when you think about it.
It really is.
We do start backing up stuff already on Saturdays sometimes, or during the race it's more or less normal where we start to de-rig some bits and bobs of our equipment. Because otherwise, it would be not always that easy possible to meet those deadlines.
Just so I'm getting this right, as little as 9 hours after the checkered flags waved, Formula One's in the air again. Aye. Yeah.
It's not especially in the air, but everything has to be sealed and packed away in the mega cases, in the ULDs. And then obviously custom comes and they are taking it away to the either next airport or at least it should be ready to be moved away to the next destination again.
It is really wild. And for those who maybe haven't attended a Grand Prix or been around it, it is just the meticulousness of the setup, but also just like how vast and how much there really is and all the moving parts. It's really impressive, I think, from the logistical standpoint to just really dive into and better understand how this all comes to be. Because we, like I said at the beginning, we show up for race day. We're like, let's party. Let's have a good time. And so much has happened to get us to this point. Speaking of that, you know, you had mentioned offline that you also at one point in your deputy head of race part logistics job that you are now at, you in that process drove the truck to and from different races and whatnot. And when I heard that, I thought, oh my gosh, that there's precious cargo here, like precious cargo. Is there a little extra intensity on that drive than the typical drive on the motorway to pick up your groceries? I would think so. I'm like sweating for you thinking about that one.
Tricky one. Let's say I was driving the truck with the cars and I really was a little bit not very relaxed about it. But it's a good feeling having the nicest trucks on the road, but the load that's in there and it's what like two or at the time 300 people were working for. And it's all in this truck and the race cars and all the most valuable equipment that we had. And yeah, but it is a good thing to drive, but then it's not always so relaxed.
I'd find it terrifying. I mean, I've mentioned it already on this podcast, but I've recently moved. And this latest move, Katie, I drove the van. So I hired a van, got a friend of mine to help me stick all the stuff in the van. I found that largely terrifying because it's like all my things are in this van, everything I own, let alone Valtteri Bottas's Formula One car. Could you imagine? It'd be terrifying, wouldn't it? Again, another thing we mentioned earlier is the motorhomes that F1 takes all across the world. It's just fascinating. One of the drivers I spoke to had said, I was in this room in Austria last week. Now I'm in the same room in another country. The motorhomes have to be unpacked, built and packed up to the next race. Now, Joseph, aware this is not your job, but you must have seen it and understand how it happens. The motorhomes look like permanent structures when you see them on the telly, but they're not. How do they work and move and travel?
Basically, a motorhome for some of them, the name is totally correct because they're just trucks. Pop-up trucks.
That's not as fancy as a motorhome. That doesn't sound as fancy.
but basically our motorhome is seven trucks. And then there is the two office trucks at each side. The middle one is as well a fold-up with an upper floor and the lower floor. The roof as well spreads out over the two office trucks and the kitchen trailer at the back. So basically ours is more or less rolling all the way along. But then there is other teams. They're using a lot of more trucks, up to 30, if I'm not completely wrong, in the case of other teams. And obviously Red Bull caters like two teams and they've got about 60 trucks and it's just bots. It's like containers and they lift on top of each other. And it's built like, Lego, I would say. It's like big Lego bots. Like Duplo with the big bots on top of each other, and it's built in a matter of 2 days usually if it has to go.
I built this chair I'm sat on, Joseph, which I know what you're thinking is incredibly impressive, so thank you. But when I first...
There's also a story, I think, behind that chair another chair along the streets. Well, that's another podcast.
That's another podcast. You're right, Katie. But the shop I bought the chair from forgot the instructions. So I was faced with a massive box and a load of different screws. And it took them 2 weeks to send me the instructions because frankly, I'm hopeless at this sort of thing, Joseph. Absolutely hopeless. But until I had the instructions, I was none the wiser. Are your team the same? Does the motorhome come with like IKEA furniture, bits of paper that they go, right, we have to do this? Or do they just know?
Basically, they just know, and this crew does it for years, and I think it's almost 17 years now. It's more or less, the key people, they're more or less the same, and they're there from the very beginning, and there is like a couple of guys that really do know what's on.
My brain just doesn't work like that.
Mine doesn't either.
I think it was a lot different in the early days of this motorhome, where it really was difficult, but now...
Well, to be fair, you also get some good experience with all the race weekends that we do have on the Formula One calendar. That did help answer Danny from Seattle's question, which was he or she wanted to know if there was someone at the team who's responsible for all those things from F1 getting to and from the race. So thank you for helping answer that question. A question I had was when we talk about these new track layouts and new track locations, such as Miami over the course of the last couple of years, do you at the team and you and your teams kind of look at that and say, oh gosh, how are we going to fit everything in? Is it kind of like rolling the dice and just showing up and hoping for the best, like in Vegas, and just saying, okay, we'll see what's going to happen? Or do you guys get a lot of information prior? Do you map it out and kind of sketch it out really to know where your belongings are going to be?
Yeah, I mean, basically we do get a plan, or like our garages, which usually is like three to four garages. And then we do receive this information not really well ahead, but early enough so that we can sketch it out where what goes, because we need to hand in a garage plan as well 3 weeks prior to the race, so that all the cable can be laid, pit stop position can be marked up.
We do appreciate what you guys do, and it's really interesting to learn just a little bit more. So thank you for your time here on F1 Explains.
Such a pleasure to talk to you, Joseph. Really learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you very much as well.
So interesting to talk to Joseph. Katie, there was so much I didn't know this week. I loved that.
It was really fascinating. I think this is one of those episodes that, again, we show up at the racetrack, the TVs go on, the lights go on, and everyone is like, oh, here's a race, here's qualifying, here's practice, like we've mentioned. But really, there is so much that goes into these race weekends. And I think that's the biggest takeaway for me is, though we are kind of a part of that, Christian, I forget that the little details are such big details in the grand scheme of a whole race weekend.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? I really have learned so much. DHL and those guys and girls from the teams who put everything up and take it all down again, the unsung heroes of the F1 weekend.
That's it for now. But don't forget F1.com for all the latest news from the paddock, F1 TV for all of the on-track action, and our other two podcasts, F1 Beyond the Grid and F1 Nation.
Speaking of F1 Beyond the Grid, Tom Clarkson has probably got one of his best guests of all time. The god of F1 car design, Adrian Newey. Go and have a listen to that. It's absolutely fascinating. And send us your questions. Why@F1.com is the email address. And that is it for this week's F1 Explains. For me and Katie, bye for now. We'll be back next week.